Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episode 6, I Do. My name is Dave Gonzalez, but this week I'm getting married to a cop, so what's my fake name? It's Adam White, DDS.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and since I too am wedding a cop, I have changed my name to Julia Guglia Esquire.
And I am Neil Miller, and in this extreme fantasy scenario in which I am marrying a cop, my fake name would be Dr. Robert Strong, PhD. Although if I had to flee to Europe and put on a British, I might be a Sir Robert Strong.
Mm-hmm. We're learning is that we'd all be like titles. That's what we want in our life.
We're like...
No one will suspect this name is fake. They earned a title at everything.
Sure.
Welcome to a Lost Rewatch podcast. If this is your first time joining us here on The Storm, you should know that we split the podcast into several sections. The first section is called The Calm, and that's for people who might be watching Lost for the first time. Lost, it's a show that was on ABC for 6 seasons. We're only up to season 3, episode 6, so in The Calm, we can only talk about season 1, season 2, and the first 6 episodes of season 3. No spoilers beyond that. Because maybe people don't want that. Then we have an interview this week. Joanna, who are you talking to?
Ooh, it is Collider's senior TV editor, Liz Shannon Miller, here to talk to me about Kate Austin and what she's up to this week on Lost.
Getting married. And then after the interview, we will enter another section called The Storm. That is for talking about this episode of Lost in the context of all the episodes of Lost and our continuing fandom since the show ended oh so long ago. If you want to check out your podcasting device right now in the description for this episode, there are time codes for each section. Make do with those as you will. If you want to support the show besides just listening to it, and thank you for doing that, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you can subscribe monthly at different levels that get different bonus content. At the very lowest level, you get access to our Slack. At the very highest level, you get access to a lot of bonus podcasts, plus all our back catalog of bonus podcasts, which is an obscene amount of content. And then we also have more Feels Like the First Time at our lowest possible level. Joanna, Feels Like the First Time's going through some changes. What's up with that?
Changes. My pal and yours, Kristen Russo, is taking some time off. So I roped in 2 Jamokes to fill in for her while she's gone.
Dr. Robert Strong, PhD, and Adam White, DDS.
The Storm Boys were assembled.
Neil and Dave joined me this week to talk about Sister of the Traveling Pants and Pride and Prejudice. We'll be, you know, if you're hearing this today on Wednesday, we will be watching Pride and Prejudice in our Patreon Slack, as a group, the boys, kind of for the first time. Dave's seen it before, he just doesn't remember it. So we're going to be doing that. That's a thing. So you can hear them take their wild stabs at what Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants / Pride and Prejudice is about. I listened to this episode. I don't usually listen to episodes that I'm on, but I listened to this episode and I was like cry laughing. It was so funny. The guys are funny. So, yeah, the boys are here. The boys are back in town for feels like the first time this week. And then next week, a producer Diana will be joining us, to talk, how does it go? Da-da-da-da-da. Did I do it right?
Yep.
Some X-Men. So, you know, we're doing it, without Kristen, but she'll be back eventually. Don't worry. But that's available to all of our Patreon subscribers. If you go to, patreon.com/stormofspoilers and subscribe at any level, you can get all of those episodes and join us for the live watches, etc. That is something that we are doing. It's not the only way you can, like, be in contact with us, of course. You can tweet at us at Storm Podcast. You can email us, hosts@stormpodcast.com. We've got a couple great, spoilery, emails this week from listeners. One note to emailers. If you want to ensure your email is read out on this podcast, try to condense them. We are getting some beautiful, incredibly long emails and I can't read those out on air because they're too long.
Or maybe
long.
Also include like a summary at the top.
Yeah, you could.
That we can, like an on-air version.
Yeah, read this one.
And then write to your heart's content below it if you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, write me an abstract and then write me the full thing. And I'll read the whole thing, but yeah, I need the abstract to be able to read it on air. So that's just a little bit of a feedback. And speaking of feedback, you can always leave us a review. We've got a couple new reviews this week. I'm going to read one that is from Rockjaw216. And Rockjaw216 gave us 3 stars.
This is Josh Gad, isn't it?
And
Josh
said,
Gad from Artemis Fowl.
Enjoyable, but losing its appeal. And Rockjaw216 says, I'm a huge Lost fan. It's the only show I watch repeatedly over and over. So when a friend of mine told me about this podcast, I jumped on immediately. I didn't listen to this podcast in the Game of Thrones days, but I really enjoy Dave and Neil. They have really deep insights and discussions that make me rethink everything about the show, which I love. I liked Joanna in the beginning, but she quickly lost her appeal to me, constantly interrupting discussions and changing subjects to what she wants to talk about, overtaking the entire podcast, and giggling about everything gets really old fast. Also, I understand that these guys do this for a living mostly, but the constant pandering to listeners to pay for a subscription is annoying. I skip a lot of the podcast just to listen to good discussions. I want to keep listening because of subject matter, but my interest is dwindling. So
seems like that guy could make good uses of the time codes and skip all the stuff he doesn't like.
Yeah, but how will he skip around me talking? That's harder. You should.
Well, see, that's the thing. He only thinks he doesn't like
that. I
don't know. But he's wrong. So he'll come around.
I mean, just skip the whole podcast at that point. I'm sorry. Come on, man. I wrote that in a review. I love reviews that are like,
I like this show, except I don't like it when the hosts host their own podcast. What this needs to be is a hostless, directionless podcast. Dave and Neil need to whip out their penises and smack them against each other until it makes commentary.
All right. Yeah, no, we're not doing that at all.
Well... I guess now we're not, since it would be non-consensual, but maybe I had hopes.
This really took a turn.
That's what the review was asking for. Neil, what happened this week on the island?
Well, Dave, previously on this show called Lost, we are up to I Do, which was an episode directed by Tucker Gates. It was written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. It has a runtime of 44 minutes. It aired on November 8th, 2006, and it takes place on days 72 and 73 on the island in flashbacks. Kate, who you'll remember, even though she's wearing a wig, almost marries Nathan Fillion. This involves active fugitive Kate Austin, wig and all, walking into a room full of cops, which seems like an especially bad idea in this instance. Surviving that is not enough for quote unquote Molly.
Monica.
Right? Molly? Monica? Sorry.
Monica. Also, Monica. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you before because apparently I do that a lot, but she does marry him, doesn't she? Did you say?
Yeah. I was saying she survives that whole experience as Monica. And then her entire plot sort of falls apart over a planned European vacation and a little bit of let's call it truth lemonade. In the end, we're left with Fillion on the floor, Kate on the run. In the cages. Sawyer gets offered a day off, but Kate sort of ruins it. But it works out, because Alex shows up to the worksite looking for her dead boyfriend. The ensuing panic in Cage Town leads to yet another emotional but failed escape attempt, followed by a mature encounter. In the jungle, John Locke wants to bury Echo in the jungle. Saeed has questions. And I feel like we'll sort of kind of pick it up from there later. In Hydra Island General Hospital, after in a desperate attempt to get him to operate on the Tuma, right? Ben throws everything at Jack. Juliet brings in Kate. Ben makes promises. They even lead Jack into a room where he gets to creep on Kate and Sawyer via monitor. They really sort of pour it on there for Jack, which is why it all ends with Jack beginning the surgery on Ben, and it all goes fine. If by fine, I mean that he slices open Ben's kidney sac, which, if not stitched up within the hour, will result in Ben's demise. It's great timing, too, because it saves Sawyer from being revenge murdered in front of Kate. Now it's time to run. Damn it, Kate, run. And over the cliff we go in season 3. Here is a fun fact. After Jack agrees to do the operation on Ben, he tells Ben that he needs to, quote, to get the hell off the island. Jack, you'll be reminded, still does not know that he's on a second island. My question to you this week, who among our Hydra Islanders most deserves to be the one who gets to tell Jack that there are two islands? Let's start with Joanna. Who are you taking?
Like, just to see the look on his face?
Yeah, like, who do you think has earned the right, or, like, who does your soul want to see get to be the one to reveal to Jack that he's not on the original island?
Really quickly, I just want to say, so what you're saying is that, in theory, he's like, you gotta promise me to get me off this damn island or whatever, and Ben's like, all right, I promise.
Right.
And so, like, in theory, Ben's like, loophole,
yeah.
Got you off Hydra Island, buddy.
Oh, of course that's what Ben's thinking.
That hasn't occurred to me.
So then, if Ben's going to do what he did to Sawyer, maybe he'd hand it off to someone. You know, take this manipulation.
It's got to be Juliet, right?
Yeah, like, Juliet, I feel like she really has earned it.
She's earned it. She made him, like, a grilled cheese, a burger.
She slaughtered a whole cow.
Well, not only has she earned it, but she would be the one who'd be able to weaponize it, because she wants him to let Ben die on the operating table. And that's the thing that you could be like, he didn't even, like, fucking promise you the thing that you thought he promised
you. Well, she at least wants Jack to think that she wants him to die on the operating table. I don't know if I would be totally sold on anything that's happening in old Hydra Island General Hospital at this point.
That's a fair assumption.
Dave, is there anyone else that you'd like to make a case for who should get to give Jack the what for? I feel like there are so many candidates.
I think Mr. Friendly, because he'd do it in, like, a laughing at Jack sort of way and make him feel really bad. In which
they
case,
have had sort of this posturing relationship going back quite a ways.
Yeah.
Old Tom.
And then Tom, you know, gets a little caught off guard this episode with Jack's sudden assertiveness in the OR, but I would still like to see him, you know, like, laugh at, like, you idiots, you're on an entirely different island.
Tom,
do we still feel like we like Tom and Juliet? Like, I know we still kind of like Juliet, even though she's... But, like, do we still kind of like Tom? Like, I kind of feel bad. Tom's, like, caught in the middle.
I think
he would rather just be chilling at the village.
So, like, Juliet and Tom are both kind of complicit in stuff that I'm not, like, big on.
Super into, yeah.
But because I don't have a full understanding of what they're doing, and because they give us Pickett as, like, obviously I'm supposed to dislike that person, and Ben, who I know is the, you know, in the antagonist role, there's no Locke-like question about that. So I could see the division within the others. So it's not that I like them, but I wouldn't consider them part of, like, the villainous plan.
We have not
plan,
thrown yeah. them into the antagonist bucket.
Exactly. With the lock.
Where there is much debate as to who should be inside bucket.
That's right. All right. This week, I have a question for you before we get off, Jack, which is that Alex's voice on the mysterious intercom that seems to be able to have ghost voices sometimes and real voices other times?
Because certainly it sounds like it.
It sounds like Alex, but then they play into a trap where it looks like Ben set him up to obviously look at the monitor, and then later on, right before Ben goes under, we're told that Alex has been taken home and did not ask about Ben. So I'm just curious if it's... Do we think that Jack's having more calm hallucinations? Did that actually happen?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. Because now that I think about it, why does Jack get out? Jack gets out so that he can see the monitor, and then it's revealed ultimately that it's, you know, Ben's like right there.
Yeah.
So, but Ben and Alex wouldn't be working together. We may have found one of what they call. The plot holes.
One of those plot holes. Besides the fact that Kate says, "What I break the rocks," and he hauls them, even though that's the exact reverse opposite of their jobs. Boom! Another plot hole. Gotcha, Lost. Ooh, yeah. Bet you didn't.
Maybe they were tired at the end of this run of six episodes.
That's right. As a reminder to our listeners, this episode aired in early November of 2006, and the show wasn't back until early February 2007. So there's a big gap after Jack yells, "Run, Kate!" Like, Kate won't run. That's like her entire reason for being. Anyway, but it's still a very effective cliffhanger as our, you know, horns bend downwards and we see Lost, and then we spend weeks wondering if Kate's going to make the most of her situation to escape out of the cages. Luckily for us, we'll just be back next week with another podcast episode and we don't have to wait. But I do remember, even though I was not watching Lost at this point, I do remember this episode, my family watching it. Because I remember the "Run, Kate, damn it, run," and the "Oh," and my family being very excited for something that I was not participating in and having all sorts of questions.
Yeah, this I think is a particularly memorable one. I think because this was, as we've been talking about, you know, it was kind of a tough run for Lost.
Yeah.
There, so people were a little, you know, maybe burnt out. Maybe burnt out's not the right word, but this was the sort of thing back when this was airing that you could get burnt out on. It's not like our current world where everything is always burning all the time. but it was like you know, when it got to the break, though, it did feel like a long break. Like, I remember those TV breaks that you remember are like this one in Lost. There was one huge break in Breaking Bad. There was like a horrendously long one at the end of Mad Men.
Do you remember your first like TV season break that was like absolute torture for you? Because I remember
it may have been this one.
Ooh, nice. I think mine was.
I can't think of a show that I watched. No, Battlestar maybe. No,
I mean
they were around the same time.
I think mine is Best of Both Worlds, Star Trek: The Next Generation. But if not, it was X-Files, like Scully abduction, I think. It was like a mid-season break or a full season break. But like, I remember like both. I specifically remember about the Star Trek Next Generation one that they make Captain Picard a Borg, and then Captain Riker is like fire on the Borg cube, and then they're like at the end of season. And I just remember like months after the finale, but before actually the part two had come on, being like, I can't imagine what Star Trek The Next Generation is going to be after they kill Captain Picard. Like, I was so into it, I couldn't see another way out of the scenario that I was presented. So excellent cliffhanger, good memories. Joanna, there's a lot of dick slapping going on over here. What's happening?
I was going to say, this one's probably mine, but I am, like, super curious to know what Joanna's is.
No, I just, like, I'm afraid to interrupt you guys at this point. Sometimes our views get in my head.
Yeah, don't be. Wait, don't let that go on too long.
I think about this one a lot, actually. It's between, not a break in the season, but between seasons. The end of Alias Season 1 and the beginning of Alias Season 2, there is a beloved character in peril at the end of season one. And I don't know, I'm sure I've talked about it before on this podcast, but like, I was too naive about the way in which like television works and like actor contracts work and stuff like that. Basically, they like Jon Snowed me in a way that like really worked on me. Years later, I'd be too cynical for that to work, but back then I was like, oh my god, someone sounds really dead. Anyway, so it was Alias season 1 to season 2.
Nice. I looked up the ratings. Would you guys like to hear some fun facts about the ratings of this episode? So this episode, this is in millions, and this is United States, and this is Nielsen numbers. So this is season 3, episode 6. They had gotten all the way up to 17 million, which was good at the time a high for the show. However, when they came back for the next episode, episode 7, Not in Portland, it dropped back down to 14 million. So I think that there was this sort of season 3 starts on this high at like 18 million, and then it sort of slowly goes, you know, slowly kind of goes down, but finishes on a high, but you really see a drop off to episode 7 and through the rest of the season's more in the 13 million range. And, they would, you know, eventually get some other high numbers, but, yeah, I think this is a really interesting inflection point where this episode ends for not only the narrative of Lost, but the narrative around Lost was, sort of changed. And I think that we've said that, you know, really good episodes are on the way in season 3. So,
oh yeah.
It's interesting to look at that.
That's a scene in perspective where it's like, if I work on a, you know, cable TV show, and like the top cable TV show any like night of the week is like, if it gets over 2 million eyes, it's like a big success. It's insane.
Oh yeah, these 2006 numbers back in the day, wild
when people were watching television,
right?
the thing I want to say about this episode, I think this is a really shitty episode of Lost. And some of the like Hydra Island General Hospital stuff is really fun, but
I really think that saves it.
I think like, this is the there's a notoriously bad episode of Lost coming up, and we will talk all about it when we get there. And that is held up not only by fans but as the show creators as like, this we all acknowledge is the worst episode of Lost. I put forth to you that this flashback is actually worse than that flashback. It is so useless. Like, it teaches us nothing. Like, what did we learn about Kate? She runs. She was already in an episode called Born to Run, literally. Like, we know this is something they had scraped beyond the bottom of the barrel for, and like, there is another Kate flashback coming up that is a good one. So this is just like completely empty.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, from like reading Lostpedia and listening to the installment of the official Lost podcast, that this was a bunch of checking boxes for them, because Kate mentions being married once before, right, and then it didn't last long. And she mentions having taken a pregnancy test before, are the two things we get in this episode. And on the official Lost podcast, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse are just like, yeah, we really like Firefly and Nathan Fillion, so why wouldn't we do a Nathan Fillion episode? And I'm like, but that's like, just because you can. I mean, I guess
when too many answers goes wrong.
They were one of the first shows to realize that you can't just put Nathan Fillion on it and make it good. So I'm glad that, you know, they got there. But yeah, this episode is really boring until like the last 20 minutes. Just in a way that, even the previous episodes this season, which I'm pretty sure if you listen back to the podcast, I haven't liked, this one, it's not that I don't like it. It's just boring. It's different from being bad.
Well, I mean, we mentioned Pickett earlier as like the other we're allowed to like hate.
Mm-hmm.
I really hate this character, and not in a like, he's interesting to hate, but he's just like in what planet is there a character who's like, this is for Colleen? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Sawyer had nothing to do.
He's a cartoon villain.
Like, it's just like so beyond like human comprehension of like how a person would behave. And and let's say he is like driven crazy with grief over the death of his wife, which is understandable. Why are they still putting him on guard duty? Like, you know what I mean? Like, why is he still like an active member of the organization right now?
It really
why
sort of undercuts Ben's importance. Like, it's like, if Ben's keeping this guy around, why are we saving Ben?
Yeah, exactly. So like, Danny Pickett just really bothers me as a character. And so, like, all that stuff is just, like, really awful. That being said, even before the last 20 minutes or so, I'd say, I think, like, the Evangeline Lilly, and we're going to talk about, you know, her experience shooting this episode, which apparently was, like, extremely hard for her, out of the fucking frying pan into the fire loss. Like, last week we were like, okay, the death of a black character on the show that is, like, a dearth of black characters. I'm like, well, at least next week will be, like, a fun, fine time at the Lost podcast. And then it's like, oh, no. In 2018, Evangeline Lilly gave an interview where she said she was, like, you know, coerced into taking off more of her clothes than she wanted to while filming season 3. And I was like, oh, problematic people in the past making everything harder for us to talk about. Anyway, sorry, that's, I don't know, that's like a shitty way to frame it, but it's just like,
it's frustrating to see because we otherwise love Lost.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
like, we don't want to think those things about Lost, but
this is sadly,
if it's the truth, it's the truth.
It's sadly going to be something that's going to keep coming up because Kate's approaching her apex of importance on the series, and then like post season 4, she kind of takes a side position for a lot of it.
They reframe her importance, but I will say that, like, in the, so basically, Evangeline Lilly gave this interview to the Lost Boys podcast, and we had one of the co-hosts, Jacob Stillworthy, on our anniversary episode, and she was talking about that she felt cornered into doing a scene. I felt I had no choice in the matter. I was mortified and I was trembling. And when it finished, I was crying my eyes out and had to go on and do another very formidable and strong scene immediately after. And then she said, so in season 4, another scene came up where Kate was undressing and I fought very hard to have that scene be under my control and I failed to control it again. So I said, that's it. No more. You can write whatever you want. I won't do it. I will never take my clothes off on the show again. And I didn't. And then she also said that elsewhere in the episode, she said that the way in which Kate was sort of written, that she started the show as like a character who had her own thing going on in her own story. And as we discussed, as we started this podcast, like Kate was originally supposed to be the leader. Like Jack was supposed to die in the pilot and Kate was supposed to be the leader. And Evangeline Lilly gave the interview and she said, like, I became frustrated that Kate eventually just became this like thing ping ponging between Jack and Sawyer. And I think this episode is the epitome of that dynamic, right? Kate as like a ping pong ball. And Evangeline Lilly said she used to like throw scripts across the room in frustration, like reading some of the plot lines that Kate had to be a part of. Something that Emily Vandervoort said that I thought was really interesting about Kate was this idea that, that she started the show as a J.J. Abrams character. And if you watch Felicity or Alias, like you really do recognize Kate Austin as she's introduced to the show as a classic J.J. Abrams character. You can think about Rey, too, in that mold, if you want. And that unlike some of the other characters, she was not a character that got remolded into a Damon Lindelof character. And so then the show just doesn't really quite know what to do with her because she's this J.J. Abrams character just like hanging around in this Damon Lindelof world. And so that's the sad truth. And it's something I didn't
that
notice.
That makes so much sense.
Doesn't it?
For something that I have to say in the storm section, but yeah.
Okay. So like, it's just, it's like what happens to Kate is frustrating. All that being said, and it's really heartbreaking to hear. And I hadn't, remembered that she'd given this interview. And, so I like retroactively apologized last week for being like, I like called it like El Bear Cage sex and stuff like that. Cause like the cage sex scene is like a very iconic Lost scene, and I just did not realize the context around it. So thank you to some of our listeners for reaching out and being like, Joanna, can you please recall what actually happened around that? So thank you guys for reaching out. But and that you know, makes me not enjoy a scene that I used to really enjoy. And I'm just saying, like,
it took away one of the best parts of one of the shittiest episodes of Lost. Sons of bitches. Why can't you take a step without falling on your own feet? It's season three. Like, you should know what's going on at this point.
I want to, like, I talked about this in the storm chasing episode, but I just want to, like, again, praise the TV show Normal People, which has, like, a lot of sex in it. And there's this great LA Times article where they talked about the way in which the steps they took with, like, an intimacy coach and all the sort of stuff. The post-Me Too, let's do sex in a way that, like, makes everyone feel, like, comfortable and in control is heartening to see. It obviously doesn't happen on every production these days, though I don't know what's going to happen with freaking Corona. But, like, but it is something that can be done. It's not like anyone's saying, like, don't ever do sex on a TV show or film again. But mm-hmm. It's like, don't put your performers, especially your female performers, in a situation where they feel out of control of themselves and the way in which their bodies are being depicted. So I'm really sorry this happened to Evangeline Lilly. And for the record, like, Damon and Carlton and JJ and Jack Bender all immediately sort of, like, released a statement apologizing as well to Evangeline Lilly that this happened. But that's not why I think this is one of the worst episodes of Lost, but this is one of the worst episodes of Lost.
Yeah, that just contributes to taking away. Yeah, go ahead.
Honestly, if it's not for the last couple minutes there where Jack sort of unfurls his plan to try and save his friends, this really would be the worst one. And it is interesting when you look back and think, like, what could they have done differently? I mean, yeah, this could have been like a Jack episode, and you could have done something completely different for a Kate episode. Cause like you said, this whole backstory that they use in this episode is unnecessary. We already know all this about Kate, you know, and yeah, it just, I mean, especially now, it's like they could have done this in a way, they could have made a much better episode out of this if they maybe would have.
I think what,
you know, thought differently.
I think what they discovered in this, like, early burst of season three episodes is season one and season two had flashbacks, you know, around our, like, core Losties. And they come back and they're like, we only have 6 episodes before we have to take this long break. Let's make sure we give people all those characters they love in flashback form. And then mm-hmm. they're like, and now Kate. And just, like, the reality is they don't know. I think they do know what Kate's story needs to be at this point, but they aren't there yet in the narrative. So we get this weird filler episode, and it's not great. But, I mean, no, it's not great. Even the Locke stuff, the Locke and Echo stuff, which I do like it for being mystical, is kind of weird because he just starts off being like, oh, it was a bear. Let's not talk about it. And then even Saeed's like, do you want to talk about it? And Locke's like, nah, not really. The island will figure some stuff out. And then, you know, we got the inscription, lift up your eyes and look north, John 305 on Echo Stick, which is where we leave that plot. But even on the, like, official podcast where they talk about, this is the end of Locke's entire first 6 episode plot. So he wakes up, he's mute, he makes a sweat lodge. Sweat lodge says save Echo. He saves Echo only for Echo to run off and get killed by the monster. And apparently, according to the showrunners, the result of all of that is so Locke could get this message from the island off Echo's stick, which is weak sauce.
Which is extremely weak.
It is extremely weak. And we talked about at length last week the real reason why Echo had to leave, but also not being able to, I think, riff a better way out sort of has some hangover into this episode, because now it's like, I don't know what we were doing with Locke or Echo or Charlie or any of that in this first 6 episode stretch, because they like were at the beach for a short period of time, and John's like, I'm going to get the guys back from the Hydra Island, and it seemed like we had a direction and a mission, and then now they're wandering through the jungle waiting for island clues again, which seems like a pivot in what they wanted to do with that group, or at least they haven't properly set up or explained to the audience through foreshadowing where they're going to be in the next batch of episodes, which I think they notice, because, not to keep bringing up the official Lost podcast, but this week they make a lot of promises about things that the next batch of five episodes will absolutely contain, like answers to about this and about that. So you could tell that, like, as they're getting into the editing of these episodes, they're like, oh no, this might be a little bit unsatisfying for our audience. So we have to make sure that we're going to tell them that we're not just, you know, doing Hatch 2.0, where we're going to spend 23 episodes unraveling a button question. We're actually going to get some more answers as we get back from break, supposedly. But it does seem like even the people working on the show noticed at this point that they were running out of steam. And if you've been listening to The Storm, you might know why. Neil, you have a thirst check question here, which I think is good in our pandemic times.
Right. I was thinking as I was rewatching this episode for the second time. I rewatched it with Slack and then today, which really did feel like a form of torture, continually rewatching it. But I was thinking, you know, we have this new world under pandemic and everybody should be wearing a mask outside. I feel like that's safe to say. I hope that's not too political. Everybody should be wearing a mask. And today, in this episode, we have multiple good-looking faces in masks. We have, you know, obviously Jack, not the worst-looking guy in the world. It's Matthew Fox. But my choice is Juliet. It is Elizabeth Mitchell. I think she... If we are thinking like, who do you want a jungle of history with their mask? If they're, you know, obviously amenable to that, you know, Juliet, I think she's got the best mask face.
Dr. Juliet Burke looks tremendous in her mask. And she gives me really strong, you know, who looks best in a mask? Is Cate Blanchett in Hot Fuzz.
Oh my God,
yes.
Where
you never see her unmasked and you only have her expressive eyes to like tell you a bunch of stuff. So she gives me real Cate Blanchett Hot Fuzz vibes, Dr. Juliet Burke in her mask. Cause she has to do, Elizabeth Mitchell has to do a lot of eye acting, in this episode. So, I plus one your
yeah.
Vote there.
I was thinking the other one, sort of the underdog here, and hopefully this isn't stealing Dave's. I'm sorry, Dave. But we haven't seen him in a while, but Christian Shepherd. He's got a real silver fox mask.
Wait, are we talking about people that we have seen in masks?
Sure, anybody. Well, or anybody.
Because here's the thing: I'm going to go with
on the show.
I'm going to go with Joanna's. You need someone who has expressive eyes, and I propose to you, you could cover up Josh Holloway's mouth in any shot and still know what he was.
Oh
acting.
Yeah, because so, you still have the hair as well.
Let's see him mask up.
If I have to pick favorite eyes,
yeah, that's
on,
what I'm going
on this
for
show.
Here.
It's Terry O'Quinn. It's John Locke. The twinkle, nothing twinkles brighter than Terry O'Quinn's eyeballs. So I vote John Locke in a mask.
All right, so we just
but Dr.
get
Juliet
these
Burke
people...
is a really good one.
A really good one.
Yeah, well, I mean, once for the little while here, this is the only way we're going to be able to interact with like new people in our lives. So this is an important thing to start thinking about.
It is interesting. I did notice that like Juliet's wearing more makeup in this episode than she usually does. And I wonder if that's because they were like prepping her for being like when she goes to talk to Cate, she's just got like more eyeliner and lipstick on than she usually does. And I don't know if she was just like trying to look nice for Cate or what. I have to wonder if maybe they were getting her ready to like just be all eyes only. Under the mask for the surgery scene. I don't know.
Yeah, they're like, well, we better put her in lots of makeup for the whole episode. Otherwise, it's going to look like she got prettied up for surgery. And that's not the message we want to send.
That's not what we're trying to go for.
All right, I think that means it's time for some corners. Neil, what do we got for Giacchino corner this week?
Well, we've got two new ones. These are well-named. We have Romancing the Cage. Ooh. Which, you know, is less fun now, I'll be honest. It's a less fun one from Giacchino.
Man, why do you have to ruin everything, men?
I think it's, you know, I'm glad that I know the truth. I'm, you know, but, you know, not great. And, the other one's better, Under the Knife, which is a new theme there toward the end.
Yeah.
So Giacchino coming through, but... you know, do better, 2006, everyone. at this point. So,
our jungle of mystery moment goes to something our least favorite character says. Pickett says, Shepard wasn't even on Jacob's list. Who the F is Jacob?
Wasn't on whose list?
What's a list?
What is I'm
pretty
a
sure,
list?
I'm pretty sure that was either Miss Clues or Ben's list, and I'm sure Jack was on it. What is this guy talking about? Nobody knows. Jungle of Mystery moment. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to poor Kev, who falls down both in his marriage and while drugged, and in one outtake scene when Evangeline Lilly leapt into his arms too enthusiastically and he fell backwards into the hallway, Nathan Fillion actually fell down.
But we are immediately revoking his award because he's a cop. So it's like, he gets it, but sorry, you don't get it.
It's funny that this is maybe a Storm comment, but that spider monkey moment of Kate like jumping into his arms in the hallway, that makes me think of another later Kate scene. I'm just gonna drop that in the comm.
Okay.
Dun dun dun, more spider monkeying. Mm-hmm. The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie, award goes to John Locke this week. Says must have been an animal. Maybe the bear, talking to Nikki about what killed Echo, who is obviously not mauled by a bear.
Stop treating Nikki like an idiot.
Yeah.
I don't like that, John Locke. That's some antagonist behavior right there.
Whoa. Sort of Minnesota, you know, corner in the pocket of the man. Who the fuck do we think we are?
Don't lie to people. You know what it is. They know what... I guess the frustrating thing is, like, the rest of the camp knows that there's a weird mysterious monster in the jungle, right? Like, that's not like a...
Yeah, they all saw it on the first day when Rose pointed
like,
it out.
It was the bear. Like, everybody knows that there's something weird out there. I don't know.
They probably even all know about Kate's horse. He could have said it was probably trampled by a horse, and I would have believed it more than it was a bear.
Horse.
Joanna, this week we're bringing back Jungle of Kistery because... You know,
yeah, but we're skipping the problematic sex scene.
Yeah,
do but that doesn't mean
we're gonna get our Kistery.
We're not thirsty for our Jungle of Kistery over here. What do we got this week?
I just didn't want to let problematic loss deny us Kistery 2 weeks in a row. So, so we've got two listener suggestions, and then we've got one from Neil, one from me. So Delia, our listener, has nominated herself and Nathan Fillion as a stripper cop. So that is something that she is opening herself, Delia, and Nathan
Fillion.
The
headcanon that he's a stripper cop.
Well, because...
It's much better.
Is that from, like... This comes from our Slack Live watch. Is that just because, like, he shows up and, like... Oh, he shows up in...
In her hotel room. He shows up kind of like a stripper cop would.
Yeah.
But it's also confusing because it's kind of how a real cop would. It's
right.
Not great.
And then you're like, why is Kate's wig look like that? And you're like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything's bad. When is taco night? All right. So Phil has nominated Kate and Juliet, and I'm really into that nomination because mm-hmm. I really like the scene where Juliet goes to get Kate from the cage. I think it's a good one. Neil, in his most Corona-attentive way... has nominated the masked doctors, Dr. Mask Shepherd and Dr. Mask Burke.
I mean, they have a whole hour.
Yeah,
it's
just
to make
out.
What else are you going to do?
I think one of our medically educated listeners has pointed out that, like, I think Jack says he, like, nicked the kidney sac.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, there isn't a kidney sac.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that Jack actually knows that and is just, like, completely lying. So if he's saying like, oh, I nicked his, bladder, ventricle or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Julia's like, oh, yes, yes.
Ah, yes. The liver bone.
I assume at least Jack knows how to fix it. Cause otherwise this is a terrible gambit.
Well, I'm just also not sure there's anything wrong. Anyway.
He just cut the line that made the beeping go faster.
Yeah. Exactly. Cut the blue wire. And then I would like to nominate Alex and her dead boyfriend, whoever he may be.
Wherever he may be.
Yeah. 6 feet under, I suppose.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's the one who has waltzed himself into that speaker, and now he's just part of the machine.
Doing an Alex impression.
Yeah, an electro boyfriend.
An e-boy.
All right, so here's to Alex and her e-boy. Her ghost or dead e-boy.
You can vote for the Jungle of Kistery poll by following us on Twitter at Storm Podcast. Next corner is Where's Libby? Since Libby got booted off the show far too early, we like to place her in flashbacks. I placed her this week. She's in that shopping center where Kate calls the agent, you know, outside. But she's inside buying supplies for her upcoming trip to Australia.
Can I just say that Kate is like, I can't do this. I can't do taco night. Kate, taco night rules. I just don't bring taco night.
It's also not that hard.
If you want to be like, I can't be married to a cop, sure. I can't be married to Nathan Fillion. That's harder for us.
I can't have a baby. Very understandable.
I can't have a baby. Sure. I don't have a passport, so we can't go on our honeymoon. Sure. Like all those fine, but don't bring taco night into it. It did nothing to you.
Yeah, you could absolutely do taco night, Kate. How dare you? It's time for the official podcast check-in. We're going to talk about religion this week. Neil will be reading the part of Damon Lindelof, and I'll be reading the part of Carlton Cuse.
Okay. Here's the question. Do you want us to become Christians? By Usama? This is a multi-tiered question here, Carlton. Why?
The answer to the first part is yes.
Why is there so many? Why is there so many talking about religion in Lost? And why is there a focus on Christianity? Do the people who make Lost and produce the show want to make people convert to Christianity? The episode was mainly about religion. Even Ben asked, do you believe in God? By the way, only Christians believe in God. If you want Lost to be an international success, you need to avoid religion. By the way, I like the show because it always makes me think peace.
Wow.
So defend yourself.
I don't even know where to start. Maybe I should start by saying, as a person who is Jewish, do you believe in God?
I do.
So I think that kind of takes care of that. That swipes away one aspect.
Rumor has it that also Muslims believe in God. They just have a different name for him.
Correct. And I would say, you know, many other religions also kind of believe in God in one shape or form.
Right.
So Catholicism, you know, there's a fair amount of Catholicism in the show, but
we had a priest on the show.
We had a priest on the show, and you know, I think the priest's demise, Mr. Echo's demise, was very much wrapped up in the sense of spirituality, which is very informed by his Catholicism. And you know, we also think the Bible is a big source of inspiration for us. It's a pretty popular book.
By inspiration, you mean rip it off at every possible opportunity.
Absolutely, exactly. Like I said, it's a pretty popular piece of work.
Well, we think the show is spiritual and is in a spiritual space. And, you know, Lost has always been more. It's not just that they're lost on an island. They're also sort of lost in their own lives. We're not preaching or promising or, you know, trying to convert anybody. But we do like the idea that, you know, these people are all connected, that there is sort of a sense of, you know, a higher power. And we try not to call it anything, but obviously the characters see it through the prism of what their own experience is. And if they were Christians or Catholics or Jews or Muslims, then, you know, in the same, we've seen Saeed pray, for example. In the finale of last year, you know, he has his prayer rug when he's on the boat before he goes to war with the others. So, you know, we just like the idea that we're not trying to make any sort of statements.
Not about a specific religion, but, you know, the idea that spirituality is an important part of human existence.
Wow.
There you go. And scene. And now it's time to go to Joanna's interview with Collider.com's Liz Shannon Miller. They're going to talk about Kate. They're going to talk about shipping. They're going to talk to you right now. Spoiler free. Let's go.
I got so excited about it because I like Sawyer so much that last week I was like, yeah, you know, in the spoiler section, like Cage sex is coming next week, blah, blah. And then some of our listeners with a better memory than me pointed out that Evangeline Lilly gave an interview to friend of the pod, Jacob Soulworthy, over on the Lost Boys podcast back in 2018 about presumably this episode, though she didn't call out this scene specifically, but we can probably assume that this is what she's talking about feeling, I think the word she uses, cornered into nudity and doing a nude scene that she was like really, really uncomfortable doing, and then having to do a really emotionally upsetting scene afterwards. And there's a couple options in this episode for what that might be. And then later having to do it again in season 4 on Lost. And then basically for the rest of her career, not doing nude scenes because of how traumatic it was for her, which takes, in my view, all the shine off the bear cage sex, knowing that the actress was under duress, when she was doing the scene. I was wondering, Liz, you know, what your thoughts were on that and how that maybe changes the way that we talk about this episode.
Well, it's funny because, one thing I will mention is I have a theory that the nude scene she was really uncomfortable. I feel like probably the scene she's referring to is the bear cage scene because that is a pretty naked scene, especially on her part. Like her, pretty much all of her torso gets exposed except for, you know, the key network unfriendly bits.
Right.
I feel like though there was a more uncomfortable scene earlier in the season when she's coerced into showering, in front of somebody.
Yeah.
And I forget the character's name, of course, but like, that's,
yeah.
But I think like, I mean, I don't remember the level of nudity in that scene. I probably should have gone back and double checked when I was thinking about it. But I feel like there's a chance that that scene might be what she was referring to just because emotionally it's so much more disturbing. But also this scene is also very naked. And the point is clearly she was an actor who was not comfortable with being asked to do these things. And she was coerced into doing them anyway. And that's unfair. And, you know, to be clear, like I you know, just before we chatted, I sent you a screenshot from an upcoming episode where it is like the entire shot is framed around her in a bra and underpants putting on a pair of jeans, and it is just gross. And
her head's like, not even in the shot, and that's that's even grosser to me than like what we see in the cage, because it's dehumanizing, that framing of it. Yeah.
And who knows, maybe it was a body double, but probably not. It was just, yeah, it's like, I mean, at least with the bear cage scene, like it's a consensual act between two adults. Like it's great that she's now able to speak about it openly. And it's great that we're now having the conversation about it. And I mean, in general, I listened to the last episode of this podcast you did with Mark Bernardin. And I really liked his point about how he has been, you know, the creators of Lost have been really actively vocal about, we've made mistakes, we recognize those mistakes, we're trying to learn from them. And I think this is another thing that falls into that category, but I also think it's something that they've tried to learn from.
Yeah, they did. They issued, I should say, like a really hasty, like Carlton Damon, J.J. Abrams, and Jack Bender issued a really swift an unequivocal, like, we're sorry, no performer should ever be made to feel uncomfortable, we're like mortified that this happened, we've reached out to her personally, sort of statement. Not that that, you know, makes everything better, but I just wanted to say that, you know, they did respond and they did take responsibility for the position that they put their actress in. And we've been talking about this actually since the pilot. There's a shot in the pilot of Lost of Evangeline Lilly, like in like a tank top and just her underwear, like washing herself in the ocean, and she turns around, and it's just sort of like, why? At the same time, we have seen plenty of like Sawyer shirtless. That is also a thing that happens on Lost. Lost does not hide the fact that it's like hot people on a desert island. So like, that's part of the appeal of the show. It's just, there are certain lines that are crossed, and for Evangeline Lilly in this, presumably this episode, maybe in a different season 3 episode, that line was crossed, and it sort of, it takes the shine off it. The other thing that I want to say that, you know, this feeds into something a little bit more pleasant that you want to talk about, which is something that she said that she was like frustrated by, was that Kate starts the series as sort of this incredibly capable, with her own story, character, and then just becomes the linchpin of a love triangle between Jack and Sawyer. And eventually Lily was like, I used to throw the script across the room. I was frustrated that that's what my character became. I don't think she stays in that role, but that's certainly sort of where she is right now in the show, and specifically in this episode. I don't know if you saw the interview. She gave this interview also about The Hobbit, where she was like, they promised me in The Hobbit I would not be in a love triangle. They promised me. And then they put her in a love triangle between like Legolas and like Keely or whatever. And you're just like, oh, Evangeline Lilly, you definitely deserve better. So I want to talk about love triangles in general, and maybe this one specifically, and hear what you thought about that.
Well, I think it's really interesting at this very specific point in the Lost, in the history of Lost, because this is still a couple of episodes before other notorious episodes that may or may not have been a factor in the Lost producers going to ABC and saying, hey, we need a plan for how this show is going to work. And I'm trying to keep this as vague as possible because I know we're not talking about spoilers beyond that. But this, I mean, and I think the thing about love triangles to start off with is they're a great way of killing screen time. Like, if you need to stretch out storylines between three characters, like having a back and forth between two men or two women, like that's a lot. You know, a love story between two people, theoretically, or a love story between two people, as many producers would like to think, is relatively simple, A to B, you know, there's, you know, happily ever after. But, like, if it's a love triangle, then it's complicated, and you can get seasons worth of drama out of it. So it's totally understandable to me that Lost, at this point in its history, was like, yeah, let's lean into the love triangle aspect.
There's also... you know, I've written about this a bunch, and I'm sure you have too. And in looking at like fandoms, you know, what is the fuel that drives a fandom, and especially like modern online fandoms? And the shipping community is just like a huge part of that, right? Like, if you can get a good ship going around your show, and love triangles are perfect for that, because you can get like arguments within the ships, and everyone is so passionate about it, and this is like why Tumblr was created, etc. So I didn't even know, I think until I interviewed Lindsay Romaine in our first season, that Sawyer and Kate were Skate, and then Jate was Jack and Kate. I didn't know that those were the names of the ships, but obviously those are like the two competing ships running through the show at this juncture.
Today, I you know, wanted to brush up on the history of Jate, and so I googled about it. You know, Jack and Kate first kissed to find the, you know, if I find like a timeline of the relationship, and I learned about Jate for the first time, and I felt really sad. I mean, it's a portmanteau. I think that they could have done better. I mean, and they're not working with a lot there, but they could have done better.
There's got to be something with like Austin and Shepard that they could have done, like, to get us somewhere other than Jate. I think that's true. And I want to be clear. Like, I'm not look. I think, you know, as long as they're not toxic and like aggressively mean towards other people, shipping fandoms are great stuff. It's just when a love triangle or when a ship sort of swallows a show, and when you have writers just pandering to that aspect of the show, that's when things get boring for people who aren't as emotionally invested in it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I think shipping is a big factor, like even today.
So when you're thinking about love triangles that work, either like that were running concurrently with Lost right then, or just like in recent TV history, you know, what are some love triangles that have really worked for you? And can you like pinpoint what about them makes them work for you?
You know, the honest truth is I don't really care for love triangles all that much. Like I think Lost did a decent job of balancing it and also like introducing other characters to complicate things. Like it wasn't just six seasons of Jack and Kate and Sawyer all yelling at each other about why won't you make out with me? I feel like the ones that really interest me are the ones where there are fundamentally good and bad reasons for these people. There are fundamentally good and bad reasons on both sides. And in general, like, but I'm usually much more satisfied when the love triangle gets kind of brought to a swift conclusion. You know, Veronica Mars is a complicated show in so many respects, but I did like the idea that, you know, they basically kept playing with love triangles in multiple respects during that show, but they were always very conscious of the fact that basically they figured out halfway through the first season that Jason Doring and Kristen Bell had incredible chemistry, and they're like, okay, great, that's kind of our, we'll threaten this relationship every once in a while, but it is kind of our end game,
right?
And that, I mean, which is also like an interesting a comparison point with Lost, because it brings up the good boy versus bad boy love triangle trope, which is always really interesting, and like it rears its head in so many ways. One of my favorite aspects of it is that, you know, most of the bad boys tend to be blonde, which is weird. And
no, it's true. I mean, like, so my archetype, my type that like works really well in or out of a love triangle, the type that works really well for me is that blonde bad boy, the like the Sawyer, the Spike, the Jamie Lannister, like I've talked about this before. They're all blonde, you're right. And they're all like on a path of redemption ? And that character type, in that they're going through active growth, is something that is very interesting for me to watch. Now shove that character in like a love story that is either forbidden or fraud or whatever, and like you're really cooking with gas as far as I'm concerned. Because it's like he's changing for her, him, you know, sort of thing. So like
you can't heal somebody with your love.
I mean, especially if you're Kate and you can climb out of cages. So, you know, it's like there are ways in which it's like, I'm sure, toxic messaging, and then there are ways in which it just like really, really works for me. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. I mean, I think like an example of someone who might technically be said to fall into this trope, but I personally feel does not, is the character of Logan from Gilmore Girls, who I maintain is Rory's best boyfriend.
Agreed.
Thank you. Like many people yell at me.
No, it's a controversial take, but it's one that I agree with. And I think if people rewatch Gilmore Girls enough, they will get there. The Jess fans, I never got it. I gotta say, I never got it. I used to be a Dean person, and then I was like, no, it's Logan. It is. You know?
I mean, I think that the thing about Logan as on Gilmore Girls though was that, you know, he was definitely the blonde rapscallion, you know, poor little rich boy, but he. You know, when he and Rory became a committed pair, like he really stepped up. He was always a solid boyfriend to her. He never cheated on her. He never abandoned her. Like, I mean, these are the base level things you might expect from a partner, but you know, like he did those things. And so, yeah, I definitely feel like that, and there's potential for Sawyer in that. There was maybe potential for Spike in that, though it went down some weird paths. Yeah, like the bad boy who turns out to be pretty good is like, I think it is like such an interesting trope, and it's one that I never thought I would be really into until like when I was younger. I was a straight up Angel fan. Like mm-hmm. I was very much Team Angel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I guess maybe as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate more complexity from these guys.
Yeah, and there's also this like what happens with the Angel Jack, you know, type, if we want to like lump them in a similar category,
yeah.
There's this there tends to be, at least around this time of television, like the good boy entitlement, like just as there's like the bad boy, like she'll never love me because I'm so bad and that's like kind of appealing, there's the like good boy, like obviously you're going to pick me, I'm the good guy sort of thing, that really turns me off.
I'm such a nice guy. Why won't she like me?
Yeah. And like Jack and his rage issues. My favorite love triangle, you know, end results. Okay. It's exactly what you're talking about. You mentioned this with Veronica Mars in terms of like, sometimes TV writers or showrunners or whatever are like, uh-oh. These two people have insane chemistry, and now the show can't really be about anything else other than the insane chemistry between these two characters. And there are times when that can be a problem and get in the way of something. And then there's the times when I like really relish the way that it like fucks up the original like intent of a show. And so my premise, I submit to you the TV series Dawson's Creek, which I don't know if you're like a Dawson's Creek watcher or fan.
I have never dug in fully, but I existed in consuming pop culture in the 90s and 2000s. So I'm very aware of Dawson and Pacey and Joey.
Dawson and Pacey and Joey is just one of the best things ever, because the show was supposed to be a love triangle with Dawson, who sucks, and Jen and Joey, Michelle Williams and Katie Holmes, who both like rule in their own way. And you're like, why is this sucky guy? Because he's like the avatar for Kevin Williamson. Like, why does this sucky guy have these two women vying for his attention? And you're like, this is an awful premise for a show. Like, I mean, I watched it obsessively, but this is like a terrible premise for a show. Then in strolls Joshua Jackson, like all of his natural chemistry just like spewing all over the place. And all of a sudden, like he and Katie Holmes, who like actually dated, I think their first, like during that first season or whatever in real life, the show's like, uh-oh. It's not about that anymore. Now it's about this. And like Pacey's a similar like Sawyer sort of bad boy fuck up on a redemption arc sort of thing. And that to me is like, and then Dawson basically stops being the main character. It's called Dawson's Creek and he's no longer the main character. And it's just one of the most beautiful ways in which natural born chemistry between two actors has like fucked up the premise of a show. I will never not rejoice in that happening and root forever for Joshua Jackson. Do you have any other like love triangles of TV fame and history that you want to dive into before we go?
I feel like, and this is maybe a modern thing that maybe like 4 years from now, when A, you know, the world has grown to this degree, and also B, we're allowed to start doing making TV shows where people touch. I would love to see more exploration of love triangles where all three participants might have feelings for the other one. And there's probably examples I'm missing. But right now I'm just thinking about if this was as groundbreaking as it got for this era. But like True Blood actually did play with I think it was a fantasy sequence on the part of Sookie, which he definitely did imagine. It was Bill and
Eric. Vampire Eric, yes.
Vampire Eric. There was definitely a fantasy sequence where she imagined the two of them together and then inviting her in. And like I think we were definitely getting into the age of where thruples are a thing now on TV.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just kind of like, I feel like it's worth it. You know, that's an area that the love triangle can explore more, I think.
Yeah. We're big fans of pansexuality, on this podcast. We like Oberyn Martell, pansexual Prince of Dorne, is our favorite Game of Thrones character. So like,
he should be.
We're here for it. Yeah, and Vampire Eric will forever live in that Sawyer Spike, Jamie Lannister bucket. He is also a blonde who belongs there. So thank you for reminding me of another one of my favorite archetypes. That's a great point. This idea of will they, won't they, times three. Ooh, the power of that. That sounds great.
I remembered another one recently that I found really charming, which is on, do you watch Younger?
Yes.
I feel like there's something really nice about it. So Liza basically is pretending to be, you know, a 27-year-old. I can't remember.
Something preposterous.
Though Sutton Foster is ageless, and so it works out fine. I don't know if you could make that show without Sutton Foster, but whatever. Anyway, so she has her young, hot 20-something love interest, and she has her older, age-appropriate love interest, and both of them find out her secret at different times, and it affects them in different ways. But I think that's a love triangle that really captures something interesting about the idea that there are the people that you feel like you should be with, and there are the people that you want to be with, and there are people who could give you things in a relationship that other people can't. And there's kind of something beautiful about the fact that, you know, you can get different things from different people, and, you know, that doesn't, so just because one relationship ends, that doesn't mean you can't move on and find something that you may have not been getting before.
Yeah, the that's a really good example, Liz. I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think the compelling reasons for her to be with both of those men, like, just keep resurfacing as that show goes on. You're never like, hasn't she moved past this? Or like, the younger guy is just like a fling and a physical thing. Like, no, he has incredible depth and like brings a lot to the relationship with her. And then, you know, yeah, that's a really great example. And that's a really underrated show too, I think. So I'm glad you brought it up.
It is, if you're listening and you haven't watched it, it is on Hulu. It is such a light, breezy binge. It's created by the same man who created Sex and the City. And it's got just that watchable light energy that is very soothing.
I'm mostly there for Miriam Shore, but I'm there for everything else as well.
Miriam Shore, Debbie Mazar. More people should talk about the fact that Miriam Shore and Debbie Mazar are on a TV show together.
It's true. Plus, like, everything they get wrong about the world of publishing also makes me laugh. But some things right, too. So, you know, it's fun.
It is hilarious. Their running thing about with their fake Game of Thrones author is chef's kiss.
Yes, it's perfect. All right, Liz, I think we did it. I think we did love triangles. I think we did, you know, everything we could do with this particular episode of Lost. Yes. Go ahead.
I was going to make a joke about how I'm really glad that Evangeline Lilly wasn't in a love triangle between Paul Rudd and an ant in Ant-Man.
It's true. She finally got her wish. Marvel was like, we're gonna leave this one be. I don't think they even made her, maybe with Corey Stahl, like a little bit in the first one, but hopefully not really.
I think he hits on her in a kind of gross way, and she's like, no, thank you.
Yeah. She's like, no, this isn't one of those projects where you're charming, Corey Stahl. This is one of those projects where you're slimy.
Have you seen my haircut? I'm all business, baby.
Liz, if people want more of your thoughts on television, where can they find them?
I spend probably too much time on Twitter. That's at Lizlet, LIZLET. I'm now full time at Collider, which is a delight. So you can find me there writing and editing bunches of stuff. I just recently got to rank all of the Legends of Tomorrow episode titles.
What's number one?
Number one is Romeo v. Juliet, Dawn of Justness. But coming in, I think at either number two or three, I forget because it went back and forth a bunch of times, was a guest starring of John Noble.
Nice.
In an episode that does, in fact, guest star John Noble.
Nice. Very good.
As himself. It's been such a pleasure being here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Liz. All right, now is the time of the podcast where we like to thank our Small Council subscribers, that is, our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. I would like to start by thanking Daniel, Aaron, Siegel, Greenberg, Lily Lim, Derek Doc, Vince Lewis, Russell Griffin, Philip Durrett, Tyler Iman, Elizabeth Chandler, Karen Einter, Gregory Gergerian, Brandon Lee Tenney, Kelly Stollard, Melanie Rodriguez, Sarah Carmichael, Spencer Howard, Wong Lee, Michael Sample, Jenna Mandel, Chris Ernst, and Rosa Peretta. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that our thanks to Ashish Sridharan, Kayla Sargent, Annie AK, Stephanie Breitbach, Becky McMorrow, Matt Campbell, Bronwyn Beck, Aaron, Jillian Q. Johnson Arnold, Jeremy M. Johnson, Joe Torrance Fernandez, Aisha Glover, Kelly Edison, Tay, Kelsey Elmerger, Jennifer Barrett, Hayden Simpson, Grace Vasington, Rebecca Glover, and Liz Wilson. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following folks: C.S., Paul Cole, Maya Finkelstein, D'Alton Dane, The New Sword of the Morning. And I'm told this next one is not a typo. I should check out some Miyazaki sometime. Excellent. Also, Claire D., Sarah Halliday, Javier Ernesto Fuentes, Kristen Plant, Mark Marquez, Katie Rich, Ben Goretzky, Amanda Rhodes, Miranda Blankenship, Kyle Davis, Sean Nee, Matt Thompson, Davia Giannini? All right, that felt right. That felt good. Carrie Welby Solomon and Zoe Fuchs. Yep, I'm going with Fuchs because it's safer to say on a podcast. Sorry. But yes, thank you to all of you.
And we're back to clean up some storm things. When I was referencing that thing that in response to Emily Vanderwerf's point about a J.J. Abrams character being stuck in a Damon Lindelof thing, I was like, oh my god, and they make her a bad parent because that's the only thing they know how to do. So that was my response. Joanna, what spider monkeying are you looking forward to in the future?
Wait, you think Kate's a bad parent?
I think that, no, I don't think she's ultimately a bad parent, but I do think that's the conflict they try to put her in.
That's so interesting. I feel like they do a kind of a good job later by reframing Kate's relationships as more centered on Aaron and Claire and Cassidy. Like the way that they center her and Son, like they center her relationships around women a bit more than they do in later seasons. And it's sort of like it's a little too late at that point. But I actually kind of I like that the reason Claire comes back to the island, the reason that Kate comes back to the island ultimately is for Claire. I think that's so much better than she comes back for Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, just something to think about. Yeah. Spider Monkey is in Jack when she and Jack are playing house, and like she and Aaron, like they've left Aaron's room, and she and Jack like do some like make out, let's go have sex business in their hallway of their home, and it's a similar Spider Monkey move.
She's a little leap.
It's a go-to Kate Austen move, so you have to respect it.
Yeah. It's her own little widow's throw.
The other storm thing I want to say really quickly before anyone like writes us a note, we know Carl's not dead. We know who Alex's boyfriend is, B, that he's not dead. It's just like Alex herself in the episode says, like, they'll kill your boyfriend just like they kill mine or whatever. So she thinks
I think Carl now that we're
dead.
In the storm, we did a very good job of playing dumb in the calm this week. Mm-hmm. We had that.
I think we should all be proud of ourselves.
We had Jacob. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff.
Your Jacob acting was very good.
It was a real minefield this week.
There was our whole
potential spoilers.
There was our whole podcast, official podcast check-in, which is actually just the end of the show that they outline in the middle of a season 3 podcast. There's a lot of good stuff in the calm this week that nobody knew about. But since it is here in the storm, it's time to do the Locke antagonist check-in because he is withholding necessary information from people, which, as you know, is one of my least favorite character tropes. On television, I've relaxed that a little bit for Lost, not only because Terry O'Quinn called me out, but also because Damon Lindelof mentioned that in one of our interviews, in retrospective, he sort of sees the ability of Lost to keep characters from talking about what's going on as one of the show's strengths. So when it works, I think it works really well, and I'm trying to look at it more like that. This doesn't, as I said on the main episode, I think it's just a natural spillover of they had to clean up the Echo situation, and because Locke and Echo were positioned as sort of like this two sides of the Man of Faith coin, Locke's internal island logic, which wasn't necessarily on good footing to begin with, gets even more muddy in these first 6 episodes. But we'll be coming back around to Locke with purpose as soon as he communes with the island a little bit more, and we have some Mikhail.
It is already kind of weird for him to be keeping stuff from like Saeed.
Yeah,
like isn't Saeed on the A team? He's on the A team.
Yeah,
you know. So it's like I don't know. I mean, we know that you know the next problem to solve is like where did our people go? I don't know. Could have been helpful to have Saeed on your side to start that project.
Joanna, apparently we have many a email.
Oh, we have a few. Well, I really, really quickly want to say a way in which this flashback could feel, because the other flashback that I was referencing that's upcoming in episode 15, we get like Kate and Cassidy being like gal pal grifters in a flashback, which I like.
And we're just like, where's that spinoff series?
Yeah, where's that spinoff series, and where's that idea for Kate? And like, and what's great about that flashback is, like, we get the Cassidy and Kate relationship, like, is a thing going forward from there. And so it makes that flashback feels important. That could have just been an isolated, like, whoa, she knew Sawyer's, like, the mother of Sawyer's kid. That's crazy. But it's like, it's folded into the fabric of the show. And so I was like, why didn't, like, don't you feel like we should have gotten a scene maybe with Kevin?
Like, shouldn't Kevin have taken over as the guy who was chasing Kate through her life or something right. like that?
Maybe something like that. But like, when she comes back and she's part of the Oceanic Six and she's on every news
station
everywhere.
Like, that's Monica.
Yeah. Wouldn't Kev be like,
he's still passed out on the floor several years later.
Like, I feel like Kev should have showed up as like maybe like a rival for Jack or something like that, you know, off island and been like, yes, you lied to me and you roofied me, but I'm glad to see you're alive and your hair looks better and I'll help you raise this kid that's not yours or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, make Nathan Fillion feel more important. And maybe he was just like busy castling or whatever he was doing at the time. But, I feel like Kev should have come back for like one more.
I loved you episode. So much, Monica. I decided to blow up my mother. And then now that I know how it feels, we can be together.
Yeah, here's her locket.
Here's her locket.
You know, it's one of those classic, you get this a lot with the big shows. It's almost like they knew they were making a bad episode and they were just like, well, this
but
sucks.
Like, okay, but
you know,
let me make an argument against that. I think you're right, mm-hmm. but I think the smartest thing to do with something like that is to like lean in and claim it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, what I think that one of the smartest things I think Avengers Endgame does, with its use of time travel is make even inessential feeling, like installments of the MCU, like Thor, The Dark World, suddenly mm-hmm. like really important to That's the fabric of this larger story. And it like confers importance on this movie that like most people would just like shunt to the bottom of their MCU ranking list. It's still probably at the bottom, but like, you know, now we've got, you know, that great scene with Rene Russo. And so then it just feels more important. So like if Kevin were important in a later season in some way, you'd be like, okay, yeah, not the greatest episode, taco night, blah, blah. But like, this is where we first meet Kev.
Yeah.
And he's going to come back.
Kevin.
You know?
Aaron's so. Dad, Kev.
Yeah.
You know?
He would have been a really good stepdad.
He could have, I mean, he needs a different line of work, as we discussed. You know?
Yeah.
He's handsome. He could do just about anything. And he could have been all right.
He could just be like, oh, listen, I was a stripper cop the whole time. That that was my lie.
I think that's
the whole point of the Kate thing is, right, is like it gets her up to the closest she's ever going to get to like a normal life, and she still can't do it. But even that, it's like we knew that about Kate.
Yeah.
So it's
well, if we're looking at like the production schedule at this point, so they're going off air to do the other batch of the episodes later. They've written about five into the next batch so far, but it is also in this break that they successfully negotiate with ABC to an endpoint.
They successfully negotiated after Stranger in a Strange Land.
Which they've already written at this point.
No, but I think it airs and they use that to negotiate. So I don't think it's here in this break. I think it's after Strange in a Strange Land. That's something that Lindelof has said.
That doesn't seem like there's enough time then to turn around and bounce back to the end of season three that way then. But maybe.
Well, do you think that maybe they were thinking about it? They just didn't. They wanted it at this point. They just didn't get it from ABC until later.
Right. Maybe. Interesting. Well, I will do more reading on that.
I mean,
you can tell
that they were running on fumes.
Because they're just like they scraped the bottom of the barrel with these storylines, and it not because they actually have, because as Joanna brings up, we got a Cassidy story coming up, and we have a good Hurley story coming up, and we have a Juliet story coming up. But it's like they felt that they had to do these main characters and something about their. Maybe it's they, you know, started work on season three, like 2 weeks after season two or something, but something in their heads are locked in this, like, Hydra Island prison of the mind, and it's going to take a while to get out of it.
We'll do a little bit more research. I believe it's after Strangeland, but if I'm wrong, please email us host@stormpodcast.com.
We know you will, because if I'm wrong, no one's going to say anything.
All right, let's talk some emails. So, Rich, a listener, wrote in this really lovely, very, very long email about name meanings, and I'm going to read part of it. So forgive me, Rich, for not reading the first half of your email, but we're going to get into the names. So we've alluded to this before, but like I thought this might be a fun time to dig into a little bit. So this is the philosopher names that are used as character names on the show. Okay. So first up, John Locke, the philosopher, is the father of modern democratic philosophy, and his approach to the social contract championed that humans are fundamentally good when they adhere to society and that everyone was entitled to life, liberty, and earn property based on hard work. One of the first philosophers to argue for a separation of church and state. His writing heavily influenced the U.S. founding fathers. Locke, the character, also believes that everyone is fundamentally good, which is why he constantly gets taken as a sucker, since he wants to believe in the innate righteousness of others. His approach to leadership tries to be as egalitarian and democratic as possible, usually to his detriment. So, John Locke. Do you guys disagree with any of that? How do you feel about that?
Nope.
All right. Mm. I mean, we noticed that really with John in Cost of Living, when he's like, oh, everyone into the jungle. It's fine. You know what I mean? So, all right. Next up is Danielle Rousseau. Her namesake philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau was something of a counter to Locke, since he argued that the more structured society is, the less pure people become. Consider the inspiration behind the radicalization of the French Revolution. He not only wrote philosophical treatises and diatribes, but also wrote some fairly popular fiction, putting his beliefs into context and action. His theories balance Locke, offering a more populist democratic ideal than Locke's more representative approach. The translation of Danielle is fairly obvious and frankly a bit too on the nose. How do you guys feel about that?
She is definitely a little bit more chaotic as she moves through the world.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I like, I think that the character presents as somebody who has those beliefs, but I don't think the character actually has those beliefs, which is interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if the characters would agree with these assessments.
Right. But I think, I mean, like Locke's was accurate to a point where I could be like, yeah, that's a pretty good summation of his character. He gets suckered because he keeps thinking like people have the right thing in heart. Danielle, it's more like her actions make her behave like her philosophical counterpart, whereas I feel like her true motivations have nothing to do with that sort of structure. I don't think Danielle's like, stop building a kitchen on the beach, don't you know that's a step towards like uber society that's gonna turn on you. Maybe she is, I don't know. Maybe she just wants all the babies.
The next one everyone references is Desmond Hume, named for the philosopher David Hume. Hume essentially challenged the ability of people to reason, since life is essentially jumping from circumstance to circumstance, and that emotion was more of a guiding principle than rationality. Desmond's arc is so much about circumstances he can't control and his ability to use his emotional connections, especially with Penny, Charlie, and Little Charlie, to anchor his decision-making amidst some pretty fantastical circumstances. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, yes. That one feels pretty on the nose. Yeah.
Finally, we get to my favorite character, Juliette Burke. While the writers have been explicit about using the previous three philosophers as guides for those characters, I really haven't heard anything about the application of Edmund Burke's philosophies to Juliette. Burke was a British politician during the post-US Revolutionary War and is considered a truly moderate philosopher. If Locke is liberal and Rousseau and Hume are radicals, Burke effectively straddled the line between those philosophies and the more traditionalist in British government. His philosophies feared both aggressive democracy and authoritarian leadership. He felt that operating the government required a degree of intelligence and breadth of knowledge of the sort that occurred rarely among the common people, and that lack of intelligence would offer the opening for demagogues and tyranny of various minority associations. He's considered a lesser philosopher, mostly because he focused more on concern and reaction than proactive ideals, which is really interesting when you think about how his philosophies apply to my beloved Juliet. Her arc in season 3 is very much about tearing herself away from Ben's demagoguery and her value of intelligence driving her decision making. Over the course of her growth on the show, she continues to straddle the line between maintaining the status quo, season 5 LaFleur and moving things forward, wanting to go home. Her push against her fear, first shown in Not in Portland, to control her own destiny, sadly, and whatever happened happened, aligns quite well with her namesake's philosophies. So what do you guys think of Dr. Juliet Burke?
Wow. I really feel like that's one of the ones that if you took that to one of the showrunners, if they didn't think of it, they'd be deeply impressed with that connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know? I think it's good criticism. I don't know if it's unmasking of intent.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe, who knows? But that's a really good one. If it were true, that would be amazing.
I would love for Rich and anyone else listening to do this with some of the other characters. We've got Faraday. Yeah. Faraday
Ben
is a
Linus,
good option.
Because he also believes in the Great Pumpkin.
Ben Linus.
All those shepherds. Christian shepherd, really?
Charlotte is like she's Charlotte Stapleton Lewis. I forget whatever the S is, but she's a C.S. Lewis. Is Charlotte's name. So yeah, if there's any more that you guys like want to explicate for us, I love this shit.
Original ones are always interesting to me. You know, your John Locke, because they came up with that before they really knew that people were going to be paying attention. But then we get to some of them toward the end, and it's like, oh, they totally knew that people were paying attention now.
Yeah. And then Glenn's email. Okay, Glenn did this really smart thing in his email. Glenn wrote about the title of Glenn's email is Jack is Hillary Clinton. And I'm like, oh, click. I'm interested. and then Glenn really brilliantly, I like read Glenn's whole email. And I was like, okay, but I'm not going to read this on air. And then he concluded it by saying, this is probably too nakedly partisan to read on the pod. I was like, oh, challenge accepted. All right. So here we go. Thanks for your podcast. I've been a regular listener to several of them over the years, and I've been in on the Storm Lost rewatch from the get-go. I got to say, though, that as I listen to the Storm week to week, I feel like I'm reliving the 2016 election with Jack cast in the role of Hillary Clinton.
I am in for this more than Ben Linus believes in the Great Pumpkin.
Storm listeners. Oh my God, Jack is so annoying. He communicates poorly and he's arrogant. Me, who do you prefer? Storm listeners. Sawyer, that homesome charm really tells it like it is. Me, you realize he's a pathological liar. Storm listeners. Yeah, but Jack is just yuck. Me, the other guy is literally a racist criminal con man. Storm listeners, but Jack has trouble letting go. Me, Sawyer steals from people, destroys their lives. He went to Australia to kill someone. Storm listeners, you'll see. He'll act presidential after the election. Me rolls eyes in complete despair. Glenn says, I'm being sarcastic to an extent, but in all seriousness, this kind of false equivalency thinking is a big part of what's wrong with this country, and I think Jack bashers would do well to see how their attitudes mirror the attacks on Secretary Clinton during the last election. There's even an undercurrent of the anti-elite, anti-expert mindset that hurt Clinton and is ever-present in MAGA discourse. Remember how Hillary was accused of arrogance and of being out of touch because she was so educated, so qualified, so experienced with the kind of tough decision-making that leadership requires? Jack is a character who has, in every facet of his life and profession, been rewarded for making quick decisions in the most high-pressure situations and expecting, as a surgeon, that everyone around will immediately cooperate. If things go wrong, the bad outcome will be 100% his fault. Much of Hillary's career, especially when she was Secretary of State, is similar. Obviously, people who live like that will have those professional qualities spill over into their personal and social lives as well. There's a deep streak in American life in which con men and crooks are preferred to experts and professionals. I think that attitude was used against Hillary, and if your listeners are honest with themselves, plays a role in their dislike of Jack, too. I could go on and on, especially about Kate as an attack on the rule of law and what that says about us in the age of Bill Barr and the attack on the Mueller report, but I'll save some for a rainy day. One last thing, though. I totally think Locke is an antagonist, but not in any of the ways you've been discussing.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
To me, Locke represents the fundamentalists, the QAnon posse, the incels, the anti-vaxxers, et cetera, et cetera. And let's say it, he would have been a big-time MAGA, and we all know it. It would have made him feel so seen and heard and powerful. He is that part of, and yeah, let's say it, white male America who must be special, must be chosen by God or by their hero. He's been conditioned by magical thinking to reject science, even while being quite talented in the natural specialist crafts and will passionately endorse the next thing that tells him he's special. When it inevitably breaks his heart, the next user will be right along to scoop him up. Can't you just hear John Locke's voice? Don't tell me I have to wear masks. So John's not evil, but he's evil's willing victim. He's not Trump, but he's a Trump voter. Anyway, thanks for reading, Glenn. Okay, so
I feel like that's what I should have sent to Terry Quinn.
I don't know that I think John Locke would have voted for Trump.
Yeah, I don't. You really sort of lost me with the John Locke. I really appreciate this email
because this is the type of criticism that I think it's good to apply to nonsense fiction. I think it's great. I think it's a great way to try to, you know, view this.
No, I like the
lens.
Email a lot. I don't agree with it, but I like it a lot.
Oh, no, no. I don't think I agree with it, but I also think it's hard to prove it wrong without getting, like, super nitpicky in the way of, like, well, this action was the smoke monster. This action was John Locke being, like, misled.
Well, okay, so like specifically with Jack,
yeah,
I have a thought.
Yeah,
yeah.
So like, okay, so I get it. Like, if you're voting for someone to be president, like not being a fascist, for instance, is a low bar to clear, but it is a good bar to clear, right? Like, you should clear the not a fascist.
Sure.
You know? But that doesn't mean that we can't ask for more. From that person. That doesn't mean that, like, progress is not achieved by then bullying in a nice political way that person into doing things to make everything better. So with regard to Jack, it's like, yeah, I get, you know, there are situations, especially in this episode we're talking about, where Jack is both useful and purposeful and very smart and self-sacrificing. You know, we're watching him try to sacrifice himself. Essentially to save his friends. He's trying to save Kate and Sawyer.
Well, he's like, you guys get to go back to the beach. Sure. I get to go back to Los Angeles.
He thinks he's sort of win-winning it, in his own very Jack way. But yeah, it's like, you know, I don't like hate Jack. I just think that like there are a lot of situations where Jack is not helpful. And I think that's the way the show uses him to a certain extent. But that doesn't mean he's fun all the time.
I would just say that, like, some of the criticisms that Glenn levies at John Locke, in terms of the, like, entitled white maleness, could very much be applied to Jack. I don't think it's just like, oh, Sawyer is such a charming con man, and that, like, is there something of a double standard going on there? Yes. But, like, I think what we've really been able to identify with, like, the appeal of Sawyer is the appeal of, like, movement for a character, right? Like, he's moving towards something. And since we're in the storm, I can say that, like, the best version of Sawyer, which is, like, LaFleur, is not Trumpian at all. So, like, you know, it's true that Sawyer is moving towards something, like, morally rooted.
He will be more presidential when he elects him.
He is the goddamn president of the others, basically. I mean, sorry, Horace, but, you know, essentially. I don't agree with everything, but I do that expertise bias, that is interesting to me. And that is something that really disturbs me about, our culture. Something that, like, a lot of, our listeners who are in our Slack, who don't like Jack, have pointed out, a few of them tend to work in the medical professional field, and they're critiquing Jack as a bad doctor. But what they really are critiquing is the show as bad doctor writing, because I don't think Jack is
the show's
to be
like
a bad doctor.
Kidney set.
Yeah.
No, the show wants us to believe that Jack is a good doctor, but he's keep showing us not great doctor stuff.
He healed Sarah.
Right.
He's a miraculously good doctor. I mean, yeah, he was gonna like guillotine Boone's leg at one point, but other than that, like
that Jack, worked. I think.
Jack is supposed to be a good doctor.
He's more of like a Ben Carson figure where they keep saying he's a doctor, but you're not sure how that works.
I think the writing is just not supporting him where it needs to. But yeah, so like, is Jack more qualified to lead than other people? Does the fact that he is like a doctor and so has like a very important life-saving skill, and does that make him more qualified to lead? I think in certain situations, yes. And it's the same reason why I think Locke is very qualified to lead, because he's got that like naturalist sort of leadership skill as well.
Yeah. I feel like it's a question that Lost is more interested in asking than necessarily answering all the time.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
But I think it's okay to say that, like, I don't think it's like snobby and elitist to say that like someone like Jack, who has this like skill set that he went to school for a long time for, is more justified in, you know, giving some orders than like Frogert Neal, you know what I mean? Then like Joanna, who can't even fucking swim her morning laps without getting pulled into the riptide, you know what I mean? So like, I don't want Charlie in charge of my days and my nights. I would prefer to have Jack. So, you know, I'm not a Jack lover. I just think that there's some good points.
There are worse options than Jack. I guess if that's your whole point, then yes, I agree.
If that's your point, then yes. All right. I think that about does it for this week. Neil, where are we headed next week?
Well, I can tell you where we're not going next week. Wherever we're going, it is not in Portland, which is the title of this Juliet. This is the first Juliet episode, right? First Juliet flashback.
Yeah, and what's funny is it's very Ana Lucia. There's like two Juliet flashbacks that are pretty close together this season. So I don't know. Like my thesis last season when we were dealing with the Ana Lucia of it all was that they like did this over again with Juliet, but they did it right with Juliet. Mm-hmm. So that's something to keep in mind when we're looking at her first flashback episode. Like, how is this, you know, better than the way in which they handled the introduction of Ana Lucia?
Yeah, man, aren't you glad we did the Ana Lucia episodes with the whole cop revenge murders, like, oh my way God. Before all this?
I can't believe this is a cop episode and we didn't even have to, like, really deal with it.
Yeah, we're just like, hey, good, Nathan Fillion should get a new job. Fillion. All right, cool. We've moved on as a society at that point, or we could just say that.
Well, he does get, you know, drugged at the end.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. Anyway, at least it wasn't at a Shake Shack. Let's tell people where they could find more of our work online until next week. Let's start this week with Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you can always get me at filmschoolrejects.com on Twitter at rejects at one perfect shot. If you're in our Slack, if you're in our Patreon, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, this week, following this episode, Saturday, June 20th, 3 p.m. Central, we will begin watching Avatar, The Last Airbender, which is on Netflix. We're going to watch two episodes a day for about a month. Come hang out with us.
You just kind of like said Avatar.
Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Which is fine, but I just kind of want to call it Avatar now. I'm not like trying to make you feel bad about saying that. Because
it's the Avatar Chronicles.
I mean, yeah. Wait 10 years and it'll be called Avatar because there'll be fucking seven Avatar movies. This one takes place in the mountains and James Cameron's been shooting it for 17 years.
I can't wait to watch it for the first time. It's going to be super fun.
I'm so excited for Neil to watch this. Dave and I have just recently gone through it. It's so good. It has a little bit of like a ramp up as any show does. So, you know, like it may not be like the most brilliant thing you see right out of the gate, but I'm so excited to watch it.
And because Neil's doing two a day, just wait a few days.
Right.
Just wait till like Wednesday.
Joanna, where can people find more of your work online?
Ooh, not having milkshakes at Shake Shack. You can find me online at Joe Wrote This. I've got a podcast that I'm doing right now called Truth Versus Hollywood with Dave Chen, where we are digging into the true stories behind some of your favorite films. Right now we are doing Goodfellas. So we had episode one of Goodfellas and then the conclusion, episode two of Goodfellas,
Lufthansa.
This Friday. The Lufthansa fight. Avatar, The Last Bender.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where we have brought the fighting back because people are starting to have wrong opinions about things like Defy Bloods or The Last of Us Part 2. Check it out. We're fighting again.
Is it people or is it just David Ehrlich?
Well, David Ehrlich is at the center of a lot of it, but you might be surprised who fights him. this week on Fighting in the War Room, and next week on Fighting in the War Room.
What? David Ehrlich, antagonist check-in. Love to see it.
That's right. And as always, we will be here on this feed talking to you about Lost and urging you to not fall down.